Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a repeat of history, as the neoconservatives who brought us the Iraq fiasco are apparently manufacturing another case for war, this time with Iran. Jeremiah Gulka, a specialist on the politics and policy of U.S. national and homeland security, joins us. He was sent to Iraq by the Bush administration to investigate the State Department-designated terrorist organization Mujahideen al-Haq, the MEK, who the neocons are now using as a source of intelligence to build a case for war against Iran. Then we will speak with author and historian Kevin Baker about his essay in the New York Times Sunday Review, The Outsourced Party, which explains the strategy and mechanism behind the Republican Party's drift towards right-wing radicalism and the extent to which, through their interlocking networks of billionaire-funded think tanks, media propaganda outlets, and judicial activists on the Supreme Court, they are carrying the country with them. Then finally, as some 70 Western and Arab foreign ministers meet in Turkey with the Syrian opposition to forge some unity and respond to the Syrian regime's foot-dragging on the UN Arab League's peace proposal, we will discuss alternative approaches with Henri Barki, a former member of the State Department's policy planning staff. He has a recent op-ed in the New York Times, in the Los Angeles Times, Syria in the Balance. If the international community wants to stop the bloodshed and prevent disasters, it needs to act rather than react. Joining us now is Jeremiah Gulka, a writer and public policy analyst who specializes in the politics and policy of U.S. national and homeland security. From 2007 to 2010, he was an analyst at the RAND Corporation, where he conducted research for the U.S. military. He was the lead author of The Mujahideen al-Haq in Iraq, a policy conundrum. A member of the RAND team, he was also a member of the RAND team that helped end Don't Ask, Don't Tell, a staffer on the Congressionally Mandated Military Leadership Diversity Commission, and an attorney with the U.S. Department of Justice. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeremiah Gulka.
Thanks for having me.
And just tell us about your trip to Iraq back in, in the introduction, I suggested that that to some extent we've seen this movie before with Chalabi and the use of the bogus intelligence that he generated along with the neoconservatives who were pushing the agenda. All of that's pretty clear on the record. And in fact, there was quite a bit of tension between Chalabi and the State Department and the CIA. And during that time, you were sent to Iraq, during the war, you were sent to Iraq to look into the State Department designated terrorist group, the MEK, and their activities on the Iran-Iraq border. But it feels in many ways like we've seen this movie before. And as much as the MEK seemed to be involved in generating intelligence on what's going on inside of Iran, that's being used by the same people who brought us the Iraq War, not surprisingly, some of us have some qualms or suspicions about that. So, I guess I've set the context. Go ahead and tell us about, one, whether you accept that premise, and two, your trip to Iraq to look into the MEK.
Looking at the MEK, there are a lot of strands that are hard to unravel. There's a lot of kind of confused information out for two reasons. One is that the MEK, through its political arm, which is called the National Council of Resistance for Iran, with NCRI, which is also listed as part of the MEK as a foreign terrorist organization, they do a very good job of presenting themselves as being a pro-Western liberal democracy organization. So it has sort of a touchy-feely approach that some people have jumped into supporting because it sounds good to them in a sort of the enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of way, just as the same thing has been said about Chalabi lots of times. And again, another mantra goes along with that, which is what looks good to be true probably isn't. What I was sent to Iraq to look at was when I was at the RAND Corporation, we had a client, which was the Detaining Operations Command of the Coalition Forces in Iraq, which was formed after the Abu Ghraib scandal came out and the military decided to take a little bit more control over what was happening in the detainee camps. The RAND project was largely to help them release detainees, so that was a good thing. My bit was a subpart, which was to look at the U.S.'s sort of weird dalliance with the MEK in Iraq, where there was a sort of detention set up. The group was consolidated at its largest of its several camps in Iraq, Camp Ashraf. And so my job was to help figure out what some of the legal issues were there, how to help resolve the question of where should these 3,400 members of the MEK go, since Iraq didn't want them to stay, and then provided some background about the group. And so now the State Department is with the UN Human Rights Commission is in the process of implementing the recommendations and trying to get some resolution regarding the people there. So when looking at the MEK issues these days, there are kind of multiple strands. You have one issue, which is dealing with the people who are in Iraq, and then you have the issue of the folks trying to get in the U.S., trying to get off the foreign terrorist organization list. And then you have the question of the former official, U.S. former officials who are lining up behind the MEK to help get them off of the foreign terrorist organization list and also to promote war, or at least the threat of war with Iran.
Well, these former, a lot of them are prominent officials in the George W. Bush administration. They're not just trying to help the MEK get off the terrorist designated list, but they're also accepting, fairly generous lecture fees from the MEK, who seem to be well funded. These are figures like Tom Ridge, the first head of Homeland Security, Francis Townsend, Attorney General Michael Mukasey, UN Ambassador John Bolton, former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, former Democratic Governors Ed Rendell and Howard Dean, ex-FBI Director Louis Free, and retired Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff General Hugh Shelton. Jeremiah Gugger, for people who don't know about the MEK and their importance and relationship to both Iran and Iraq, and why they became a resistance group within Iran during and after the Islamic Revolution that brought the Ayatollah Khomeini. They were headquartered inside Iraq under the protection of Saddam Hussein, and they've launched terrorist attacks inside Iran for since the revolution. And then, of course, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, a simple way of looking at it is they were founded by a graduate student at the University of Tehran in 1965 to oppose the Shah. They participated in the Iranian Revolution, and when they weren't able to actually take some office during it, they changed their focus to be the Ayatollah Khomeini's regime. And since then, their goal has been to take down that regime, become the new regime themselves, and they signed up with Saddam Hussein to help that cause, which ended up being probably their biggest mistake, because now they're widely hated in Iran for having fought against Iran. And now they're trying to get the U.S. to basically bring the military force behind them and install them in the government.
Well, how much are they being used by the U.S. In their covert war against Iran, and more importantly, I guess, the Israeli covert war against Iran that's even more intense?
Right. In terms of the U.S. use of it, that's sort of vague. I don't have a very good impression of exactly what's going on. There's been lots of rumors. It's, of course, highly classified type stuff. There's been lots of rumors. And depending on people that politics and position in government, their attitude towards MEK may vary. Some of the neoconservatives definitely have seen them as a potential ally. There are statements by Rumsfeld and Cheney back in, 2003 when they were thinking about the on to Tehran approach of using the MEK as kind of bullet catchers essentially in the process of if they were going to go invade Iran at the time. The rumors continue. As far as Israel, as you know, it's been all around the news since NBC broke the stories of unnamed sources in the U.S. government saying that Israel is indeed using the MEK to do covert actions in Iran now. So I haven't seen a lot more follow-up on that story.
Well, what about the intelligence angle, though, Jeremiah Gorka, in terms of the Chalabi, of course, was promoted heavily by the neoconservatives, even though he ended up being an agent for Iran. And even when George W. Bush was told that Chalabi was an agent for Iran and that he disclosed to the Iranian regime that the existence of a national security agency intercept or bugging of all Iranian diplomatic communications, enabling the Iranians to change their codes. The U.S. was listening into their mail. Bush was incredibly furious, but it took a while to get rid of the through the Pentagon. They dragged their heels, kept supporting Chalabi. So that's in itself an amazing story.
But it's absolutely appalling. And I think you're hitting on one of the real parallels here between the MEK and Chalabi. You know, it's not just that they're pretending to be a widely supported, proto-liberal democratic regimes, potential regimes to come bring democracy to to Iraq and then Iran. You're talking about dubious intelligence. The MEK presents itself as being this wonderful source of intelligence to about Iran because it has its network of people in Iran. When I spoke with intelligence people, officials, when I was doing my RAND research on the report, I got mixed reviews. Some people said nonsense intelligence. Some people said, sure, maybe, but you need to corroborate that for it to be quality intelligence. Other times they said, well, yeah, okay, we know what you're telling us is true because we already know it. And then they still proclaim that they're bringing in new and valuable intelligence. I think what we're really seeing is what makes the news are the things that the MEK is putting into the news, which then suits interest of neoconservatives and other folks who want to have war with Iran. So, for instance, the Iranian nuclear program is largely in the news because the MEK had a press conference in 2005 announcing the Natanz nuclear facility. And they've been waving the flag of fear about the nuclear program ever since. Now, people looking into the source of this intelligence think that it actually came from Israel and that Israel is putting effort into trying to get this news into the U.S. public to steer politics, and that the MEK was the first group that said, sure, we'll do it. We'll put it into the news.
The MEK itself, now it's amazing that they've survived, particularly after U.S. invasion of Iraq and then installing this Maliki government that's so clearly allied with Iran. They've got to be pretty insecure, and they were at one point surrounded and disarmed, I believe. I don't know what their current status is in Iraq. They're very active over here. Years ago, they tried to kind of recruit me. Decades ago, they seem to have a lot of money. Where do they get their money from? And isn't it a kind of a cult-like operation? I believe Bunny Sider's sister was involved with them. So can you flesh that out for us?
Sure. The first short response is to where does the money come from? That's sort of the big question, and that's what the Treasury Department is currently investigating. They've subpoenaed a couple dozen of the former officials, including the ones you listed, who have been taking $10,000 to $20,000 to $30,000 per speech to speak on behalf of the MEK to promote them and to suggest that they should be removed from the Foreign Terrorist Organization list. Saddam is reputed to have given them a lot of money when the leader, Mariam Rajavi, was arrested in Paris in 2003. Several million euros were found in her home or office, which was arrested. They have money, but again, the question is exactly where is it coming from? And because they're on the FTO list, the money that they use or get has to be laundered, and so it all becomes quite criminal operations. As to the group becoming a cult, well, what happened when the MEK leadership left Iran? They're basically exiled when Khomeini's regime started suppressing them brutally. they ended years later in 1986. They end up in Iraq, setting up with Saddam's help to participate in the Iran-Iraq War. And Saddam gives them money in exchange for intelligence and translation skills, and participation in the Iran-Iraq War.
And interrogation of Iraqi prisoners too, right?
Of Iranian prisoners.
Iranian prisoners. Yeah.
And well, now they're out in the desert, and they're having a hard time getting new recruits. Just about a year before they moved to Iraq, the leader of the MEK, his name is Masoud Rajavi, he arranges a divorce from his wife, who was Bonnie Sauter's sister, marries enforces a divorce, and then marries the wife of one of his chief colleagues on the MEK, who is Miriam Rajavi. The two of them become the co-leaders of the organization, and they turn it into a cult of personality. And so what you've seen in Iraq is a cult group that is absolutely not promoted in their daily life towards values that we would associate with Western-type human rights or liberal democracies. Instead, we've seen brainwashing, control, sleep deprivation, sexual control, emotional isolation, and a host of basically human rights types violations that I reported on in the RAND report that you mentioned, and Human Rights Watch published a report in 2005 discussing. And so these are things we largely learned from former members who've talked about their experiences, and through trying to triangulate and corroborate different stories we've heard from different former members that I interviewed or read reports from, and the Human Rights Watch interviewees. It's somewhat chilling.
So, Jeremiah Gorka, the MEK is very active over here in the United States. Obviously, they've been spending, $30,000 per lecture fee on people like Tom Ridge, former Homeland Security Advisor, ahead, Francis Townsend, Attorney General Michael Mukasey, U.S. UN Ambassador John Bolton, Rudy Giuliani, Governors Rendell and Howard Dean, ex-FBI Director Louis Free, and retired Chairman of the Joint Chiefs General Hugh Shelton. Many of those people, were involved with the Bush administration's war in Iraq. What is the extent of their network over here? And again, we don't know where they get their money from, but they run a very slick PR campaign, and they're trying to get themselves off the terrorist list. What do you know about their traction within the Iranian-American community?
It's hard to tell, because they are really good at AstroTurf campaigns, fake grassroots campaigns. They have all sorts of front organizations in the U.S., they probably deny that they're front organizations. They say that they independently are supportive of the MEK, at least in order to get around the material support of terrorism laws. When they have protests, they often will have big demonstrations or protests, but some of those have been shown to just include people that they've bussed in from different church groups and different organizations without saying exactly who or what it's for. Often just bussing folks in saying, do you support democracy or in the Middle East or in Iran? And people say, sure, and thanks for the bus fare. Mm-hmm. It's hard to get the sense of exactly how truly robust their support is in the U.S. Now, the people who do support them support them very intensely, but how many of them is really an open question.
Well, also, the final question would be, and why do they do so, knowing that what an unsavory group they are? It seems like an exercise in kind of cynical realpolitik. Is that if that's the best that we've got in terms of agents inside Iran, it doesn't speak well what about the Green Movement? What about the thousands and millions of Iranians that rose up against the regime? Why are we dealing with these murderous thugs and not dealing with those people?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, so when you talk about the support in the U.S., you have, I think, some authentic sort of volunteer or cult member type members of the MEK, and then you have the the cynical political people who want to have, who are interested in having war with Iran or promoting even the threat of it, and so therefore they use this particular group to promote fear of Iran and make it seem like a much greater threat than it is. And, you know, to loop it back to Chalabi, the journalist Ali Gharib wrote an article on the Loeb blog September 10th of 2010 that specifically ties the supporters for the MEK with Ahmed Chalabi, even down to links that come down to a house in Virginia where some of the same people are operating, the same operations are supported Chalabi, and now they're working on behalf of the MEK because they wanted war in Iraq and now they're wanting war in Iran.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Jeremiah Gorka.
Thanks so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Jeremiah Gorka, a writer and public policy analyst who specializes in the politics and policy of U.S. national and homeland security. From 2007 to 2010, he was an analyst at the RAND Corporation, where he conducted research for the U.S. military. He was the lead author of the Mujahideen al-Haq in Iraq, a policy conundrum, a member of the RAND team that helped end Don't Ask, Don't Tell, a staffer on the Congressionally Mandated Military Leadership Diversity Commission, and an attorney in the U.S. Department of Justice. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the Republican right-wing radical machine that appears to be taking over America.
I can see by your eyes you must be lying when you think I don't have a clue. Baby, you're crazy. If you think that you can fool me, because I've seen that move.
Today, as the flag still stands for freedom, and they can't take that away. And I'm proud to be an American. The men who died, who gave that right to me, and I gladly stand up next to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kevin Baker, who is the author of the City of Fire series of historical novels, Dreamland, Paradise Alley, and Stryver's Row. He was the chief historical researcher on Harold Evans's best-selling history, The American Century, and wrote the monthly In the News column for American Heritage magazine. His essay, The Outsourced Party, appeared in the March 25th edition of the New York Times Sunday Review. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kevin Baker.
Thanks for having me.
And your article points out, I think, something that it should be obvious, and that is that the Republican Party has been moving to the right for half a century now.
Yeah.
And has generally been carrying the country with it. And it's pretty clear, I think, that just in the last week, we've seen some extraordinary activism on the part of the Supreme Court. Of course, conservatives always talk about activist judges referring to liberals, but the extent to which the Republicans are activists in terms of the judiciary and the legislative and executive branches merging in terms of their agenda is pretty breathtaking. You pointed out some stuff in your article that I think is really important for people to understand, not just what's been well known in the past, and that is the role of Lewis Powell, who was a Republican corporate lawyer whose next-door neighbor was the head of the Chamber of Commerce. And in response to the 1960s anti-war movement, he wrote the famous memo, Attack on American Free Enterprise System, which then led to the creation of the Cato Institute, the Heritage Foundation, the Manhattan Institute, and the modern Republican policy machine, if you will. I know I'm going on here, but I'm trying to give some background. At one point, soon I'm going to let you talk. The point that really got my attention was that in 1986, a pair of Ronald Reagan's judicial appointees on the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, Robert Bork and Antonin Scalia, ruled that the FCC's fairness doctrine was not a binding statutory obligation. And that led to Reagan being able to toss out the fairness doctrine, which moderated political speech for decades, and thus began the right-wing propaganda machine. So forgive me if I'm being conspiratorial, but I see a real relationship here between a kind of revolving door between, or at least a compact between the Republican Party and Republican judges, and particularly Supreme Court justices.
Oh, certainly. They're highly partisan judges, and they are judges who are quite willing to reverse themselves on principle if it means backing the conservative cause. You know, for instance, the Obama administration was apparently very surprised to find that Mr. Scalia was not supportive of them in argument because he had ruled before that the feds had the right to clamp down on marijuana pretty much wherever they wanted to. You know, I mean, it shouldn't be a great surprise. What they do is they support various right-wing policies, and one of these is, you know, no marijuana and no health care. So it's perfectly consistent with their partisan attacks, not with any kind of principle. In the case of the Fairness Doctrine, what you have was a one of Reagan's campaign lawyers, a man named Mark Fowler, who led this fight against it. You know, the idea behind the Fairness Doctrine had been that, unlike, say, taking a printing press and printing whatever you wanted, the band waves of the broadcast spectrum is limited. So therefore, it's important that anybody who has a license on that give a both deal with important public issues and try to present all points of view. Fowler totally disagreed. He saw television particularly simply as, quote, just another appliance. It's a toaster with pictures. So he led this fight to abolish the Fairness Doctrine. And Justices Bork and Scalia ruled that, indeed, the Fairness Doctrine was not a binding statutory obligation, that it was simply a rule, a regulation that the FCC had put in. And then he and this then led to Reagan's FCC voting 4-0 to abolish it once they realized they had the power to do that, once it had been confirmed that they had the power to do that. Ever since, Democrats in Congress have periodically tried to get a move, going to kind of to put the Fairness Doctrine into law. But they were, you know, attempts to do this were vetoed by President Reagan in 1987, by President George H.W. Bush in 1991, and they've been stymied in the Congress ever since by Republicans. They're adamant that this should not come back, because what it has done is create a clear field for them in the area of radio in particular, where they can have as, you know, many kind of we're in right-wing radio simply like right-wing talk radio simply dominates the airwaves now, and they don't want to give up this sort of monopoly they have on it.
Well, they were able, though, to hit since they created the they knew what they were doing. And this is, I think, what we're really talking about here, Kevin Baker, is that the Republicans really do engage in strategy and long-term thinking.
Sure.
And the Democrats basically bumble along and play catch-up.
Yeah.
The significance of the Fairness Doctrine was that it moderated political speech, because a media owner, if he wanted to sit on his own soapbox, he had to offer equal time to the opposite argument. And by getting rid of it, they were able to hit the ground running with right-wing radio, but also, and go back to the days of Father Coughlin and Colonel right. McCormick, but they were also, it allowed for a Murdoch. The murderification of, if you will, of the media, where bilious billionaires who own the media, the airwaves, can push their points of view. And now, of course, it's extended into buying the elections thanks to Citizens United.
Yeah.
So it's an amazing, I mean, I really recommend people read your article, The Outsourced Party, to get an idea of the ties, if you will, between the media, the right-wing media, the judiciary, and the politicians, and the way they all feed each other. And this whole week has been taken up with talk about broccoli. Nobody's talking about the real health or the lack of health of the nation. And you realize in many ways that they've won. And I think they're going to win the next election.
They may. Certainly they will, I think, if the economy goes in for another dip. But I think, you know, brilliant as this strategy has been, and it's been very brilliant, as you say, it's focused really around the media. You know, they believed, I think quite unfairly, but they believed in the 1960s that the media, the mainstream media, was innately unfair and unbalanced against them. This was kind of extraordinary, since the vast majority of newspapers then as now endorsed Republican candidates. But in any case, this is what they firmly believed. So they went about establishing an alternate media, and it was quite brilliant. You know, I really wish liberals had been able to think as clearly in the electoral process. And this worked very well for them for years. But I think to a certain degree, it's all come a cropper this year in the sense that by so outsourcing so much of their political megaphone, they have created, they've turned a lot of the whole process over to entities that don't necessarily have a stake in their winning. You know, I mean, I'm sure they would all want to win, you know, but if Rush Limbaugh, for instance, if the Republicans don't win this year, well, Rush Limbaugh will probably have all the more angry far-right Republicans calling up to his show and boosting his ratings. The thousands of lobbyists they've created since the Powell memo, according to one estimate, the number of Washington lobbyists went from 175 to 33,000 in the 40-plus years since the Powell memo. But, you know, the thousands of lobbyists there they have, if Obama is reelected, then they'll have all the more reason to say to the money behind them, look, you need me in here to keep these regulations from being put in. They've also run a cropper in the sense of having, you know, with Citizens United and having all these individuals who will kind of back their personalized candidates. You know, Foster Freeze, the billionaire with the Batman villain name, backing Rick Santorum almost single-handedly. The Adelsons backing Newt Gingrich pretty much single-handedly and pushing for a war in Iran. These people have really extended the primary process in ways the Republican Party would rather they not have, and made the party look all the more extreme and, you know, really hurt it in some ways. I mean, the Republicans don't want to run this election on the questions of contraception, you know, but people like Rick Santorum have forced them to so far. So I think in this sense, this is sort of starting to plague the party now.
Well, Kevin Baker, again, the author of an essay, The Outsourced Party, that appeared in the March 25th edition of the New York Times Sunday Review. He's a best-selling author of the City of Fire series of historical novels, Dreamland, Paradise Alley, and Stryver's Row. But the party itself, though, the traditional, I mean, nobody, I think, fits the definition of what the Republicans used to be better than, say, Sandra Day O'Connor.
Yes.
And, you know, she got replaced on the Supreme Court by a political hack, Alito, who's, you know, Scalia's shadow. And Powell, by the way, went to the Supreme Court. So, I mean, I'm beginning to see a kind of pattern here, if you will. But there used to be, and the idea of the liberal media was a canard because it all it's done is move the goalposts to the right. They've invented this mythical liberal media, and in order to overcome it, you move the goalposts to the right. And we've seen that pattern. But, of course, you know, PBS used to be dominated by William F. Buckley, who would debate his good friend George McGovern. And in those days, liberalism and conservatism were contested in a very civilized way.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not a good thing to overestimate how much comedy there was sort of in the old days. I mean, there were already, you know, going back to the 30s, the right already started kind of a vicious, personalized attacks, making out that liberals and Democrats were kind of alien and un-American, you know, and this certainly, you know, perked up with, I mean, we remember Goldwater now as the avuncular old man of the Senate he became. In 1964, he ran a very frightening hard right campaign in which he opposed things like the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, things we now think of as pillars of our democracy, and called for using nuclear weapons to destroy the foliage in Vietnam. So, you know, there always was this sort of extremist element. It has certainly gotten worse and worse. I mean, it used to be both parties had sort of a liberal wing and a conservative wing, which made for some very useful, creative crossing over in the aisle to get certain things done. And now that that is less and less the case, I think we're, you know, I think the democracy does suffer from it.
Well, but this current Republican Party, the one that you point out, is largely outsourced with where these outside players like Fox News and Limbaugh in many ways set the agenda. But there's also this new phenomenon of the forgers and fabricators, these kind of really nasty people like David Bossie, who is the Citizens United decision. It was his documentary. He was fired by Dan Burton. Dan Burton was forced to fire him because he edited provided the prison tapes of the hapless Webb Hubble, who was Bill Clinton's first attorney general, and he manipulated those tapes to make it to incriminate him, and eventually it was found out, and Dan Burton had to fire him, and then sure enough, he ends up making the documentary that becomes the basis of the Citizens United decision, and you've got the Andrew Breitbarts and these people who just edit stuff and have absolutely, you know, almost like a Goebbels-like determination to destroy the other side and push their message at all cost. And in many ways, it feels that the new Republican right are kind of Stalinists. You know, they just want to destroy the other side and just, you know, dominate with their ruthless tactics and their finely honed message.
It's true that they don't seem to have any kind of moral principles at the end, any line beyond which they won't go. I mean, they really, I think you're quite right about it being Stalinist in nature. I think they really are a revolutionary party. They see themselves as such in the sense that they feel it's legitimate to simply try to overturn everything that we take as an established part of American society, which is to say things like Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. You know, they do think they're a revolutionary party and therefore feel justified in taking any kind of revolutionary actions they like, such as lying and cheating and editing, you know, that horrible attack that Andrew Breitbart launched upon that poor woman in their cultural department who was talking about how she had overcome, you know, racist feelings toward whites, and instead he edits that to make out that she was operating in this racist way. Horrendous attacks on people who are not big public figures, but just regular, you know, working people.
But the party itself, but Kevin, the party itself, its latest commercial, they manipulated the Supreme Court recording of the Solicitor General making his incompetent argument. You know, they manipulated that. That's the party itself. That's the party brand. It's not the freelancers.
Oh, yes. Yeah, the party brand itself is also pretty horrible. But I think tactically the party would like to operate a little differently at times. And unfortunately for them, maybe fortunately for the rest of us, their kind of nasty, inhuman face keeps getting exposed by these individuals, such as Foster Freeze or Adelson and all. I mean, I don't think the American people want a big debate on whether or not contraception should be banned. You know, and I think the Republicans as a party realize that, but here's this guy, you know, forcing the issue. I don't think the American people, for that matter, want a war in Iran. But again, you know, it's the Republicans are kind of being forced into this more by Adelson than they probably would like to be. But yes, yeah, certainly a lot of people in the party are quite willing to go off on their own radical tangents. You know, certainly Paul Ryan's inane budget ideas are another example of how radicalized the party is getting.
Well, just in closing, though, how do you explain the venom and the energy and the activism that's largely based on illusions, that one, that there's a liberal establishment, that there's a liberal elite? The country is run by powerful, rich people, most of whom are Republicans. We basically have more of an oligarchy than a democracy. It's true that they buy both parties, but they own the Republicans outright, and they half own the Democrats, or they rent them. So it's just it's a complete illusion, but at the same time, there's real passion. The Breitbarts of this world are driven, and they've made up this nemesis. This, you know, there's nothing more pathetic than the Democratic Party. You know, they can't get out of their own way, and the nation itself is angry and bitter and confused and venal in many ways.
I think a lot of it is people are terrified and confused by what's going on in the modern economy. You know, we've seen so many of their jobs offshored, outsourced to other countries. People's entire standard of living is threatened. Any prospects for their children. And Democrats don't seem to grasp that. I mean, I've been amazed to the degree to which, for instance, both President Obama and Timothy Geithner, his leading economic advisor, seem to not feel that the housing crisis is a big issue for people. I mean, here you have millions of Americans who are going through the traumatic, bankrupting humiliating process of losing their homes, and neither the president nor his closest advisors seemed to have felt that was a big deal. You know, and I think as long as these sorts of things are happening without any kind of recognition by elite Democrats, Republicans with their simplistic, often ludicrous, often mythological bogeymen will have an advantage. You know, there needed to be a counter narrative that people such as the president needed to come up with, and they have basically spurned that, and it's something they continue to pay a political price for.
Well, what do you think? Is there any way that, I mean, obviously, the Democrats are playing catch up, and a lot of analysts, George Lakoff and Drew Weston among them, have said that it's a lot of it's to do with the deficit of messaging on the part of Democrats,
yeah.
and semantics, which the Republicans are real good at in framing. But I think it goes beyond that. It's really a question of appealing to the dark side of America or to the better angels of our nature. And I'm just wondering whether we've reached that point where the dark side has taken over, where you just don't have the ability to get. Maybe we got lucky in 2008 because of the confluence of things with the economy and that people were fed up with Bush. But I see us heading into a very angry, dark period.
I think there's every possibility of that, and I think it is. I agree. I think it's more than a matter of semantics. I think the Democrats too are run by elites who are maybe more benign than the Republican elites, but equally oblivious to what many people in this country are going through. I think they really do feel the future is simply a white collar one, that everybody should just, you know, I mean, the whole attack Santorum made, where he made out that Obama wants everyone to go to college so he can transform them into his image, you know, it's ridiculous on the face of it, but it does reflect a deeper fear and I think a worldview that the Democratic elites, unfortunately, do have. Their idea of the future is everyone should go to college and get 2 degrees and live, you know, happy white collar existences. And the fact that this is simply not possible for a great many Americans simply eludes them. And I think until the suffering that the working class and the middle class in this country are going through is recognized, there's going to be continuing upheaval, continuing confusion, and I think it could get very dark indeed.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Kevin Baker.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Again, I've been speaking with Kevin Baker, who's the author of the City of Fire series of historical novels, Dreamland, Paradise Alley, and Stryver's Row. He was the chief historical researcher on Harold Evans' best-selling history, The American Century, and wrote the monthly In the News column for American Heritage magazine. His essay, The Outsourced Party, appeared in the March 25th edition of the New York Times Sunday Review. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about Syria.
Come out, dawn too. Hustling around Atlanta in an alligator suit. Getting drunk every weekend at the barbecue. And keeping the niggas down. We're rednecks, we're rednecks. But don't know our ass from a hole in the ground. We're rednecks, we're rednecks. We're keeping the niggas down.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Henri Barki, who is a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the U.S. State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. He has authored and co-authored and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and most recently, European Response to Globalization, Resistance, Adaptation, and Alternatives. He recently had an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times, Syria in the Balance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Barki.
Thank you.
And the friends of the Syrian people are meeting in Turkey, and obviously you've something of an expert on Turkey. 70 Western and Arab foreign ministers are meeting. So far, my understanding is the Saudis have agreed to pay the Free Syrian Army and perhaps offer bribes to get people to defect. What else has come out of this meeting that caught your attention, Henri Barki?
Well, at the moment there isn't that much more, except that it's very hard at this stage for people to do anything, only because everybody is deadlocked on whether or not to arm the Syrian opposition, the Free Syrian Army, and clearly there's a great reluctance to do that. So what you saw today in terms of an agreement to have salaries paid to people fighting, members of the Syrian army, is essentially a compromise. And presumably, in a way, that part of that money is, I'm sure, going to go into the purchasing of arms. Look, in the region, finding arms is not that difficult. I mean, there are plenty of arms in Iraq, in Lebanon. Arms can be purchased. It's the big ticket items like anti-tank missiles and more sophisticated equipment that's hard to get to come by. But I think finding arms is not small arms. At least is not that difficult. But in terms of the meeting, I mean, I think we have to look at the meeting essentially as one in a sequence of meetings. That is to say, slowly people are getting together, people are exchanging ideas. The different countries, and they are waiting, essentially bidding for time. And the critical factor here will be Syria's reaction, or the Assad regime's reaction, I should say, to the Kofi Annan plan. And Kofi Annan, the UN and Arab League representative to Syria, suggested a ceasefire and for the pulling out of Syrian troops from the major population centers. And yesterday, the Syrians responded by saying that they will not withdraw their troops from the cities. That, I think, is going to be seen within a week or so as a kind of a escalation, if not a breach of UN requests, and it's going to slowly crystallize opinion on Syria. But, the options there are very few.
Well, Henri Barki, in your op-ed recently in the Los Angeles Times, Syria in the Balance, if the international community wants to stop the bloodshed and prevent disaster, it needs to act rather than react. You mentioned that a few weeks ago an Obama administration source revealed that the United States had been flying drones over Syria to document the atrocities by the Assad regime against the Syrian people. And you also just mentioned the Kofi Annan plan, which is in many ways the Russian plan. The Russian television RT, of course, who are an extension of Putin's domestic propaganda machine, have been showing pictures of alleged atrocities on the part of the Free Syrian Army. Isn't the U.S. making a greater human rights case? The head of the UN Human Rights Commissioner, she's been screaming from the rafters, saying the Syrians are actually torturing children and murdering children to extract information from parents. It's a hideous regime. My sense is that perhaps one of the reasons why the Obama administration is not releasing these pictures that they apparently have is that if they get the American people all worked up about how terrible the Syrian regime is and something has to be done, well, aren't they in a situation of having to do something and they don't really know what to do?
Well, I really don't think that the American people will say, it's time for the United States to intervene militarily in another Middle Eastern conflict. I mean, I think we are, as a people, at the moment, tired of military engagement. So I don't think that's the fear. Look, releasing such information is always difficult because it involves intelligence sources and there are always opposition within any administration to releasing such detail. Now, the ambassador to Syria, Mr. Robert Ford, did put on his Facebook pages some satellite pictures of heavy artillery concentrations around the city of Homs, etc. I mean, so we can put some stuff up, and I think we should. I believe that if we want the Russians to change their mind, we have to essentially start and engage a worldwide campaign, very much like the Kony 2012 campaign, where you've had social media mobilize people. And I think if you saw demonstrations in Europe and in the United States and elsewhere, certainly in the Muslim world against Russian interests, whether it is airlines or embassies or consulates or companies, that you will then attract Putin's attention. I mean, there is even the Kofi Annan plan, which you said is a Russian plan, so to say, is actually an acknowledgement on the part of the Russians that things are not working out the way they expected. They're trying to buy time for Assad, but even the notion of buying time means that they think Assad is in trouble. They're looking for ways to give him some support. But the time will come when they will no longer be able to protect him because conditions on the ground will change. But if we want to make sure that that moment comes sooner rather than later, my argument is that we need to mobilize public support for it. And that has to be done in terms of not just the United States, but worldwide. And that's going to get the Russians probably to think twice about how much support they offer Assad. They're not going to move away from Assad. We shouldn't be realistic. I mean, they will not move away from Assad. But they may start thinking that Assad is more trouble than he's worth, that he is a liability, that maybe it's time to look for an alternative to Assad. That already would be a great step forward.
So, Henri Bakke, you are talking, though, about employing what's referred to as soft power as opposed to hard power. You know, because you've pointed out in your recent LA Times article, Syria in the Balance, that there are two disastrous outcomes that are likely to happen in the coming 6 months, and that's a weakened regime continuing its hideous violence, and if you arm the opposition, that'll just mean more people are killed, and then alternatively, in 6 months, the Assad regime may be gone. But then you may have some bitter retribution. And my friend Bob Baer, the former CIA officer, he was talking to some of the heads of the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria the other day, and he told me they were complaining that State Department wasn't taking their phone calls. And Bob said, what are you going to do if you win? What are you going to do with the Alawites? And he said, we're going to kill them all. And he said, Bob said, well, that's probably why the State Department aren't talking with you. I mean, some people have even suggested that we could end up, because of the enormous chemical and biological weapons arsenals that the Syrian army have, with a kind of Somalia on the Mediterranean. So both scenarios are incredibly grim.
Right, and that's why I was arguing that we need to come up with a concrete plan, and we need to do it now rather than wait and be reactive. I mean, we need to come up with some kind of a game plan of ratcheting that pressure. But the meeting that we saw today in Istanbul is essentially it's a step, but it's rather meek. Just arming, just giving money to the opposition is not going to do it. You need to do a worldwide campaign. You need to make sure that the Syrian leadership, people who are involved in the violence, should know that they will be followed, that they will be eventually prosecuted. So you need to send signals to both the Syrian regime and the Syrian opposition that you mean business. And that's why I said we need to start maybe training an intervention force, kind of a peace force, that once the Assad regime falls, that there will be some kind of a peace peacekeeping force that will come in to do precisely or to prevent precisely what you just suggested, i.e. a bloodbath by the opposition against the Alawite minority. If we want the Alawites to change sides or for part of them to change sides, if we want the Christians in Syria to start changing sides, we need to send them some signal that their interests will be protected. At the moment, we know that the Assad regime has no incentive to shift change policies, but at the moment the Christians and the Alawites who back the regime also don't have an incentive to switch sides because of exactly what Bob Bauer reported to you, and unless a different message is sent to these people in Syria, this conflict is going to continue.
So, Henri Baki, what about another track at the UN via the Human Rights Commissioner? Because she's was saying exactly what you were saying a minute ago, that Syria should that the Assad regime and the Fourth Division and the Alawite Officer Corps and Maha the Brother all should be referred to the International Criminal Court along with the Rami, what's his name, the banker, the cousin.
Makhlouf.
Yeah.
But I would do it gradually. I would say, what I would do is say, okay, here are 10 people we are referring to. We have a list of, let's say, 100 more. If the 90 left, or people who think they might be on the list, if you don't switch sides, then you will be referred to as well. You need to give people an incentive to change sides. The critical thing in Syria is that you need to change the balance in Syria. So you need to get defections, high-level defections from Assad entourage, from the military, from the security forces, from the diplomatic corps. They have remained quite loyal to Assad to date. And that's primarily because they're afraid of the day after. I mean, at the moment, they're safe, and they're banking that, you know, there's a 50% or 70% chance that they will survive, or that the regime will survive. So we need to change that calculation. And everything that has happened to date doesn't change that calculation. That's why I think one has to be somewhat pessimistic about the outcome of the Istanbul meeting, unless they will announce maybe in the next meeting, which I think it will be in Paris, more severe measures. But the trick is to change the calculations of people within the regime and the base. One of the things that's interesting is that the Kurds in Syria who have been staying on the sidelines because they're not happy with the opposition, main opposition group, which has essentially taken a very Arab nationalist and partially Muslim Brotherhood attitude. And the Kurds want essentially certain concessions. They would like a federation, but that may not be in the cards in the near future, but they want some acknowledgement of their separate identity within Syria. So they've been staying on the sidelines, and they're an important community. You're seeing some movement. I mean, there was a big demonstration on Friday in Qamishli, which is the heartland of the Kurdish area in Syria, against the regime. And you're starting to see a shift there too. If the Syrian opposition group were to be more inclusive and were to offer something to the Kurds, moving the Kurds into their column would help.
I'm sorry to tell you that we've pretty much run out of time here, Henri Baki, but I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Henri Baki, who's a professor of international relations at La Jolla University. He served as a member of the U.S. State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. He has co-authored and edited 5 books, and he recently had an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times, Syria in the Balance. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. A lady dressed in white with a man she loved.